Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of True Crime on Easy Street. We're sitting here again today. My name's Katie Givens. I'm not a lawyer.
Scott Wright, mediocre journalist, the only person in the room who hasn't been to the beach recently, I think.
Kelly Turner, not a doctor. You are correct.
Damn it. I have got to get to the beach sometime.
Whose fault is that,
Scott? It's mine. I know. Yep. But yeah, you guys are both tanned and look refreshed, and I'm just dragging along over here, as usual.
You need some beach therapy.
Yeah, well, I'll go down to Jake's on the lake this afternoon and get semi-beach therapy.
Okay, there you that's go. Good. Get a Cabo Bloody Mary.
Yeah, and some of that, I don't know what the dessert is this week. I think it's apple caramel cheesecake.
Yeah, something like that.
So I'm taking some of that home.
Jake's on the lake, not a sponsor, but could be.
Could be. I'm going to mention it to him again when I see him this afternoon.
You might be barking up the wrong tree there.
Jake, spend a dime? I don't think so.
He's like, y'all already talked about me. What do I need to spend any money for?
Right.
Exactly what he would say, too.
Jake, this is the last free shout out.
That's my fault. It won't happen again.
Last free shout out for Jake's on the lake. If you want some more shout outs, you're going to have to pay
for it. It's going to cost you.
Yeah.
All right.
He's somewhere listening going, whatever.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. I've got a shout out, but you have a, do you want to do the palate cleanser before we do anything else? You want to tell that story?
Whatever you want to do.
I'm curious. I don't know the story. You just told me the title of this palate cleanser. So please, I want to know about it.
I'm intrigued.
Yeah. This palate cleanser comes to us from Travis West, a.k.a. Shorty.
Yep.
We've mentioned him before.
A very, very avid and dedicated listener to the show.
One of our favorite fans.
Yeah.
So this was too intriguing. It was just so funny.
All right. Well, you're already giggling, so.
All right. The title of this article, this is from UPI.com.
Okay.
Turtle takes a ride in the back of Kentucky police cruiser.
Turtle.
A turtle.
Okay.
Like the animal.
I'm with you so far.
And there's a little picture of him, and he's in the back, and he's literally looking out the window of the police.
He looks so forlorn for a turtle.
So I'm just going to read this article to you because it's priceless. All right. This happened on June the 9th. So we're a little bit behind in reporting this.
We've been doing that for 3 years now. Yeah, a little bit behind.
Yeah. A turtle found loitering in the parking lot of a Kentucky bank was apprehended and loaded into the back of a squad car, but ultimately released.
I'm not sure that turtles are capable of doing anything except loitering.
Yeah.
So the Glasgow Police Department said an officer responded to Edmonton State Bank on a report of a turtle occupying the parking lot and refusing to leave.
Oh, so it was in somebody's spot. It was in the bank president's parking spot. Pull with the PD, so.
I don't know if it was the president's spot, but he was refusing to leave, or she, I don't know. I don't know how you tell on a turtle.
Let's not get into that.
I don't want to. The department shared a photo of the shelled suspect riding in the back of a police cruiser. The turtle was given a warning and released at a nearby body of water.
All right.
You know, speaking of Kentucky, the kids are going to church camp in Kentucky, but I didn't know where they were going. And I knew they were going to church camp, and I was asking Ellison, I was like, where are you going? She's like, you know, it's the state that looks like the chicken.
Oh.
And I said, and in my mind, I'm thinking like a chicken. Like
the shape of a chicken.
Yes.
The
and
body
I'm thinking,
and everything.
I don't know this state. I said, are you talking about like fried chicken? Like, are you making a Kentucky Fried Chicken reference? And she's like, no, you know, the man in the map and he's holding some chicken.
What?
And I'm
totally confused. I thought I was.
What are they teaching you in school these days?
What is happening?
Yeah.
But what grade is Ellison going into?
She's going to be a sophomore. She's 15 years old.
The man holding the chicken. So Kentucky. Yeah, I guess.
So but she showed it to me. If you pull up, I need everyone to pull up a map of the United States.
Okay.
With the states outlined.
All right.
And if you look at that map and you look in the middle, the feet of the man are Louisiana. And then you go on up from that and you can see, I can't remember. Is it? Don't quote me on this.
Oh,
anyway.
Lord, geography.
But the man is holding a platter. Which is Tennessee.
Tennessee is the platter.
And Kentucky is a piece of chicken on top.
The piece of chicken.
And that's how they learn it now?
I don't know. That's what I said. I said, how does this teach you the states? And she's like, no, that's not really That's not really what I mean. Like, that's not how we learned.
I sure hope not.
But we just learned that man's there. And I said, well, what states are in the man? She didn't know.
Yeah, I mean, when we learned the states, we got a blank map one day, and yes, our teacher said, tomorrow this should be filled in, or you're going to have to fill this in the classroom tomorrow. Go home tonight and learn it.
And then after that, it's the capital.
Yeah, each state. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was like, what, fifth grade?
Yeah, we never learned about the man holding a plate of chicken. Uh-uh. I don't know who. Someone please tell me which teacher's doing that.
I'm going to have to get that cleaned up.
Then she was like, you know, Michigan's a glove. And I'm like, I said, the only thing I ever heard.
Michigan does kind of like a mitten.
Yeah. The only thing I ever heard compared to an article of clothing or something was Italy's a boot.
Italy is a boot.
Yeah.
But that's
and we can't say what Florida is shaped like, so move along.
Oh, yeah.
This is an R-rated show sometimes. PG-13 anyway.
Yeah, I'm going to have to look at a map, though, and do this. But in the state that's the chicken, the plate of chicken.
They've arrested a turtle.
They have arrested a turtle who refused to leave a bank parking lot.
Oh, the funnier part of that, too, is she also said, the man is looking east, and that's how you know east and west. And I said, that should not be how you learn.
Never. How you know.
I said, I was on board until right now. That should not be how you're learning east and west.
If that's your only way to learn, then you're going to be lost a lot.
What is happening?
Yeah, because then you go to Europe, and then now you're all thrown off.
Mm. What? No. I've got to know which teacher's teaching this. Yeah. So that we can publicly shame this
them.
Person on our podcast. All right. So you have a shout out?
Cameron Gossett.
Okay.
And that completes our loop of the entire Mark Gossett family. We've mentioned them all on the show now.
Yes.
But Cameron, I saw her last weekend. She is about to move to Charleston.
Awesome.
Where her brother already lives and is in law school, Cade. And so Cameron said, once again, love the podcast. Can't wait to drive out to Charleston so that I can listen to it again for 7 hours in a row.
Oh, nice. So, okay. Well, hello, Cameron.
Shout out to
Cam,
and good luck with the next part of your life.
Yeah, that's exciting. Thank you for listening and taking us with you to Charleston.
Yes. Because I've never been. That's the only way I'm ever going to get there. Man. No, wait. I have been to Charleston. I haven't been to Savannah.
I've been to Savannah, but I've not been to Charleston. To
right. Charleston, yes. Savannah, no.
Okay. I've been to...
It's on the bucket list.
Yeah, I want to go to Charleston. Yeah. Now, my dad has been to both, and he says he prefers Charleston.
Really?
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, screw it. No Savannah for me, then. I've already...
No, I loved Savannah.
I love Savannah.
Yeah, okay. It's a great place.
Well, then I will go back.
So, we hope to eventually get to Charleston and see it, but at least Cameron's going to take us with her.
The highlight for me and for no one else in the group, it was girls and me, and my highlight was the aircraft carrier that is parked in Charleston. I just had to kind of drag them through the aircraft carrier, but that was the fun part for me.
But it was cool.
That and the drinking.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's fun.
So, Katie's like, oh, yeah.
All right. So do we have any more shout outs?
I'm done.
Okay. All right. Well, Scott, you are in the big chair this week.
Okay.
And you're talking about something. And I honestly have forgotten. I know
again?
That I text you guys, was it 2 days ago?
Yes.
3 days ago?
Yeah.
And said,
not long enough to have forgotten.
What are we doing?
Mm-hmm.
And you said, I hope it's this.
George Wallace.
Okay. Because that's what you've been preparing all week. So,
all week.
All right. Well.
Are we ready?
I guess I'm the dummy today.
Or maybe I am.
We'll see.
Depending on how this goes.
We'll see.
So we find ourselves this week in the late spring of 1972, and it's just about 1 month exactly after the Watergate case took place. And we covered that earlier this year in episodes 22 and 23. That was back in May and June.
Okay.
So this is going to be season 3, episode 28. So it was 5 weeks ago that we talked about Watergate. And that happened, like I said, in June of 72. So stick around because there are some ties between the story we're going to tell today and the whole Watergate mess, the people who were involved in it. You guys remember E. Howard Hunt?
Yes.
Played by Woody Harrelson in the HBO series White House Plumbers.
Yes.
He figures into this story.
Okay. Oh, okay. All right.
So we'll talk about him when we get there.
Okay.
So a bit over 1 month before that infamous event at that famous hotel in Washington, D.C., it was a Monday, May the 15th, 1972. Imagine that we are hovering in the sky like a drone above an outdoor shopping mall in Laurel, Maryland, which is located about 15 miles northeast. And here we go with directions again. 15 miles northeast of Washington, D.C.
So is the man looking at this or is the man not looking at
this? I'm totally confused if he's looking or not. Okay. It's east of Washington, D.C.
The man is looking at it.
Okay.
According to Ellison.
According to geography.
We're going to have to get her in here. Anytime we have directions on the show, we need Ellison in here to explain it to the listeners.
That's right. I was trying to look up Laurel. You said Laurel, Maryland?
Yes.
Yeah, because my brother lives kind of close to that, I think.
Yeah, it's 15 miles northeast of Washington and 15 miles southwest of Baltimore. It's right on I-95. If you're going from one to the other, you can't miss it.
Okay.
All right, so Laurel is a city of around 30,000 people. And that's as many as live in our entire county here in Cherokee County, Alabama.
Yes.
Like I said, it was a Monday. It was the day before the primary vote in Maryland on a Tuesday, right? Like primaries always are. The weather was warm that day. It was a sunny afternoon. There were about 1,000 people gathered in that strip mall parking lot. It was around 3:30 local time to hear 52-year-old George C. Wallace, the governor of the state of Alabama, deliver his vote for me for president speech one last time before the next day's vote.
Okay.
Standing on a temporary covered stage and behind his specially constructed bulletproof lectern, Wallace delivered his standard stump speech, which had not changed much since his 1968 campaign for president, when he basically created a new brand of conservative politics in this country. Wallace's bullet points, as always, delivered in plain English, not the noncommittal political mumbo-jumbo that the American people were used to hearing. The bullet points were law and order, the dangers of big government, and the politics of division. And you can insert race there for that.
Definitely. Yeah, definitely.
If you like.
You talk about Wallace, that's what you're talking about. Yeah.
So after Wallace climbed off the stage after his speech, and against the advice of the Secret Service agents who were protecting him, he walked over towards the crowd of spectators. Like I mentioned, it was warm that afternoon, around 4 o'clock by this time, so Wallace had removed his suit coat to interact with his supporters and at least one detractor, it turned out. As Wallace mingled, often reaching into the line of people to shake hands, a CBS News cameraman captured an unfortunate and horrifying series of events. But before we tell you what happened to George Wallace in the 53rd year of his life, let's take a quick look back at his entire life.
Okay.
And answer a question of how exactly the governor of Alabama ended up lying on his back in a pool of his own blood in a Maryland shopping mall parking lot.
Okay.
Wallace was born on August the 25th, 1919. He grew up in the small Alabama town of Clio, C-L-I-O, but pronounced Clio.
It is pronounced Clio?
It is.
Really?
Yes.
Okay.
That's in southeastern Alabama, all the way down in Barber County. That's close to Houston County, which is where Columbia, Alabama is, which is where the Anglin brothers ended up in Alcatraz after they robbed a bank there. Remember from our Alcatraz
our
series.
Alabama tie.
Yeah. Wallace's parents were farmers. His grandfather was the town doctor, and little George often accompanied his grandpa on house calls around the community. Steve Flowers is a former state legislator. He writes a weekly syndicated column on Alabama politics that appears every week in papers across the state, including the Cherokee County Post-Herald. He has called Barber County the home of Alabama governors, because besides Wallace, six other governors of our state were born and raised in Barber County. Wallace himself once joked that the reason so many politicians came from Barber was that the county was so poor that politics was about the only way to get out.
Oh, okay.
And remember that Wallace was 10 years old when the stock market crashed in October of 29. So he grew up poor during the Depression in Barber County.
Yeah.
Just like every other white and black person in Barber County.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
And so just like more than a few politicians to be before him, Wallace made his way from Barber County to Montgomery, the state capital, and had become a page in the Alabama Senate at the age of 15. He graduated from law school at the University of Alabama in 1942, where along the way, he had been chosen freshman student body president and became captain of the university's boxing team, and he boxed in the bantamweight class. So in college, he weighed somewhere between 112 and 118 pounds. That's bantamweight.
That is less than I weighed in college.
So that's like
it's less than
shadow boxing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm five feet tall.
Well, I guess it's a fair fight if the other guy's the same weight as you.
Oh, yeah,
right?
So
that's the whole point.
Bantamweight. The lowest weight possible?
I think featherweight is the lightest.
Oh, feather.
There's a lighter than a 112-pound grown man.
Sure.
Wow.
That's I'm gonna shut my mouth.
All right. After flying as part of a B-29 bomber crew over Japan on 10 missions in the final months of World War II, Wallace returned home and opened a law practice in 1945. He was already married to his first wife, Lurleen. She was a Tuscaloosa native. He met her while he was a student.
Lurleen.
That's right. And by the following November, this is 46 now, Wallace was a duly elected member of the Alabama legislature. By all accounts, Wallace was gregarious and confident despite his small frame. And with this election that he had won in 46, he had rekindled a love for politics that he had first discovered when he was a Senate page back in the 30s in Montgomery, right? So 1958 comes along and Wallace runs for governor and loses. And then famously tells one of his assistants a despicable phrase about which issue he would not allow himself to be outmaneuvered on the next time. I'm certainly not going to repeat it here.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, we've talked about it.
But it had everything to do with race.
Yeah, we talked about that. You brought that up in an episode, and I don't remember which one it was, but yeah. We talked about it, yeah.
So, a conveniently converted staunch segregationist by 4 years later, Wallace won the race for governor in 1962 and proudly waved his brand new race card at the inauguration when he uttered those infamous words that every student of Alabama history has heard: segregation now, segregation tomorrow, segregation forever. Actually, everybody in the country pretty much heard of George Wallace because he said that at his inauguration in January of 1963. Yeah. So that made the news everywhere.
And there went the reputation of the state of Alabama.
Kablooey, in one sentence. And then some more to come. Sure, famously.
Sure.
Famously, Wallace was much more of a campaigner than he ever was an administrator. And that's throughout his political career. So for him, the fun was in the winning, not so much in the governing.
I think there's a lot of
politicians
like that.
You're like the dog who caught the car. Oh, shit, what do I do now?
Now I'm elected.
Perhaps because of that very inclination, the next few years were a shameful time in Alabama, at least by modern standards. We will not go into the details about Bull Connor in Birmingham and the stand in the schoolhouse door and the Edmund Pettus Bridge event in Selma.
Ugh. God.
But we do have a two-part series from the summer of 2021 that you can go back and listen to. It tells the story of what happened at the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham in September of 1963. Mm-hmm. So go back and check that out if you want to get a good vibe on what was going on in Alabama.
Yeah, those are very good episodes, I think. I mean, even if we did do them, but I think we did a really great job.
Yay, us.
Yeah. Yeah.
George Wallace was not what you might consider to be an overt racist. He cloaked his segregationist views by arguing for states' rights over the increasingly persistent push on the federal level for civil rights for Black Americans.
I don't know. We may have to disagree on that. I would call him an overt racist.
Yeah, when you say
that, I think
in your
by modern standards, you're right. But I guess what I mean is, back then, he was considered not an overt racist.
I would. Wow. I'd put his name next to it in the dictionary.
I would. I think time has.
Who the heck was overt in that time then? You're getting to that. Okay.
Sort of. George Wallace was not the man who expressed his public support for the Ku Klux Klan. He did not toss around the N-word, at least not in public. Okay. The worst phrase I could find that Wallace ever spoke in a public forum regarding his feelings about race was to refer to Black Americans as unambitious Africans.
Oh.
Which, of course, is 100% racist.
Yes. Yes.
But, like we said, back in 63,
that's
how you said the...
Not racist,
you didn't say
I guess.
The, yeah, you didn't Lord. Say the quiet part out loud, and that was one way to do it.
Yeah. Ugh.
Of course, if you know anything about Alabama history, you know that George Wallace's actions always spoke louder than any words that he could have said. He did allow Bull Connor to deploy those fire hoses and attack dogs in Birmingham. And he stood in the schoolhouse door at Foster Auditorium to prevent two Black students from registering to attend the University of Alabama.
That is a very famous picture.
Yes. He also later sent his segregated state trooper force to stop the first attempt at the march from Selma to Montgomery.
Mm-hmm.
George Wallace Jr. wrote a book about his father in 2001 titled Governor George Wallace, the Man You Never Knew.
Oh.
In it, George Jr. tells readers loudly and proudly that his father was never a racist, that he was simply a man who made a Faustian bargain. He gave away his soul in order to get elected governor of the state of Alabama.
Well, I mean, and you did say that there was he loved the winning.
Right.
More than the actual what it took.
What would you
to
do
be
to win?
Governor.
What did Richard Nixon try to do to win?
Yeah, so there may be something to that.
If you'll play a racist to win an election, you are a racist.
I don't disagree with that at all.
I don't either. Yeah. I really don't.
George Jr. wrote this about his father. He wrote, and I'm quoting, "The poverty and deprivation that my father witnessed and experienced as a young man growing up in Barber County gave birth to a profound empathy for the needs of all people, both black and white." Now, these are among the beliefs of some of Governor Wallace's most dedicated defenders.
Yeah, your own son, I guess so.
Yeah. But do your research, make up your own mind.
But in the same sense, he's presenting himself and doing and saying the things that it's going to take to win this election, which is being uber racist.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, whatever.
You're right on it.
Okay.
Yeah. So in 1966, at a time when the state constitution prohibited the sitting Alabama governor from running for re-election, Wallace talked his wife, Lurleen, into running.
For what?
For governor. And she beat 9 other Democratic challengers in the Democratic primary and walked over the Republican candidate in November to become the state of Alabama's first ever female governor. Our second elected female governor is sitting in Montgomery now, Kay Ivey.
Why don't I know this?
Yeah, you know.
Because you dozed off during Alabama history in 10th grade.
Lurleen was governor, and
I'm truly the dummy.
You know,
today.
That's how, like, you know, is it the nursing building at JSU's named after her?
Yeah, one of the things that she dedicated, she passed away 2 years after she was elected. She had cancer. She did not survive her 4-year term as governor.
She did not serve a full term.
But one of the things she was dedicated to was mental health and education. And she kind of, believe it or not, in that sense, she picked up the mantle that her husband had done a lot. I mean, there's a George Wallace Community College in several places around the state of Alabama. Trade schools and education was one of his, and health.
There are
benefits.
Many, many things in the state named after him.
Yeah.
And a lot of them have to do with education.
Well, he was governor 4 times, so he had plenty of time to get his name put on stuff.
I guess I missed that she was there for 2 years, but did a lot for mental health and education.
Yeah, she did. But she passed away in 68, and so the duly elected lieutenant governor at the time, his name was Albert Brewer, he served out the last 2 years of that term, and then he ran for election on his own right in 70. But now it's 68 when Lurleen passed away. But George had to do that because he needed the platform of the governor's office in order to continue to show the people of the entire country what he would do if he was elected president. And he can't do that if he's not the governor of the state. So 68 rolls along, or comes along, and his wife passes away, but he's going to run for president in 68. And you guys know how sometimes we talk about, no matter what year we visit, when we set the table or whatever, it seems like the world is burning.
Yes.
Okay, well, in 1968, the world was fucking burning.
All right.
The still escalating war in Vietnam, starting with the Tet Offensive in January of that year, had shown pretty much every sensible U.S. citizen that the war in Vietnam was unwinnable. There were race riots in the big cities. There were student revolts against the draft on college campuses. And there were the assassinations of 2 of the most influential political figures of the day, all of this in 1968. And in a lot of ways, 1968 is still burning in this country today. And one more part of what was wrong in the world in 1968 was that one man, the de facto governor of Alabama, was running for president as a hate-filled politician in a country that already had plenty to hate and fight about.
Yeah.
And Wallace, of course, lost that presidential election in 68. That was when Nixon won for the first time. But in the process, Wallace had become the voice of the South. And it didn't matter to Southerners that Wallace had lost the election because the South had been losing since the Civil War.
Good Lord. Their choices were Nixon and Wallace that year.
Nixon and Wallace and Humphrey was the Democrat that year. Wallace ran as an independent in 68.
Okay.
So Hubert Humphrey was the Democratic nominee for president in 68. And that was a very close race between Nixon and Humphrey.
So he just couldn't get the Republican nomination?
No, Wallace was a Democrat.
Oh, yeah.
I know what you're thinking. Wallace was a Democrat, but he ran as an independent because his best hope to make something happen as a third-party candidate in 68 was to keep either of the 2 main candidates from getting a majority And then the election gets thrown into the House of Representatives, and the House of Representatives was controlled by the Democrats.
Mm-hmm. And then he was.
So Wallace wielded a lot of power, even though he didn't have a legitimate shot to win.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In fact, Wallace gained enough of a following in 68. He got 10 million votes that year. That was about 15% of all the votes that were cast. And so 4 years later, when the 72 presidential election rolls along, Wallace was widely considered to be a serious political contender.
Mm-hmm.
Again, not with a legitimate chance to win, but to become sort of a kingmaker. He had a lot of power as that third party candidate.
Mm-hmm. Why did he not decide to run as a Democrat?
Because of everything that I just told you. Okay. He had more power. If he runs as a Democrat, he's going to lose to Humphrey in the Democratic primaries.
Okay. So he knows he has no chance of winning that primary. Okay, that's what I was
His own party's not going to...
Yeah, he's too extreme for the Democrats nationwide.
That's what I was thinking, but I just was making sure.
And I think a lot of people forget that he was a Democrat.
Mind was flipped.
Because it's, you know, a lot of people... When they want to talk about racism and things like that, they want to automatically think Republican, but that's absolutely not true.
It's all
parties.
Mm-hmm. And so I was going to tell you guys this later, but since we're talking about it, let me tell you now. So there's this one theory that President Nixon, before the 72 election, reached out to Wallace and said, look, everybody in the state of Alabama knows that your brother Gerald is a fucking crook. And we're going to stick the IRS on him unless you agree to run as a Democrat in 72 instead of an independent.
Oh.
And so Wallace ran as a Democrat in 72. And the suspicion is that it was because of the threat to the IRS coming in and exposing a bunch of corruption in Montgomery. And that's a better scenario for Nixon to get reelected, because there's no way. Even if Wallace won the Democratic primaries leading up to the Democratic convention, the Democrats still aren't going to put him on the ticket.
And that
so then he's
like
out of the way.
Such a Nixon thing to do, too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, go back and listen to the Watergate thing if you think this sounds outlandish.
Yeah, does the IRS want to check out Montgomery right now?
I don't know. You just put an idea in somebody's head.
I'm just saying.
So at the time, when 72 rolls along, the 5'7" George Corley Wallace was at the height of his political prowess, already a name nationwide because of his Segregation Forever inauguration speech and the stand in the schoolhouse door, both in 63. And now he's a legitimate candidate for president. And his run in 68 convinced a lot of people that he was going to do well in 72. I mean, 10 million votes, right? So Wallace gets reelected governor in 70. Even though the Nixon campaign, here we go again with Nixon, they sent $400,000 to Brewer's campaign to try and keep Wallace from becoming governor. Because again, Wallace needs the governor's desk to stand on to run for president.
And Nixon is, he's ridiculously paranoid about everything.
Yeah.
So he doesn't want Wallace running against him.
Every president spends his first term preparing to run for his second term.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like we mentioned, that Lurline had passed away. And so the 72 election again comes along. And then about the time that Wallace is getting geared up to run and he needs something, a platform to really base his campaign on, that's when the Supreme Court determines that in order to racially integrate all of the schools in the country, they're going to bus students out of their school district and send them to other places to get the ratio of black to white that they've arrived at. So that's Wallace's federal busing of students. That's his big number one thing.
He's going to stop all that.
Send me to the White House, he says, on the campaign trail, and I will get the federal government out of your face. So once again, Wallace is running on race, and once again, he's not saying the quiet part out loud.
He's just saying, I gotcha.
States' rights.
Yeah. Yeah, it's weird to hear a Democrat say that, but yeah.
Yeah.
Who, me? They said a lot of it back in this day.
Yeah, they did.
Lots.
So in May of 1972, as Wallace headed to Laurel, Maryland to continue his campaign for president, Richard Nixon and frontrunner George McGovern in 72, they're both polling around 41%, and Wallace is at 18%, and he's in second place on the Democratic side. It sounds like a small number, but it was still concern for the Nixon campaign, just to kind of follow up on what we mentioned. Because the Democrats are never going to put Wallace on the ticket, no matter what he does. And Nixon becomes concerned that if Wallace doesn't get what he wants from the Democrats, he's going to break off again mm-hmm. and do a third party run again. And Nixon's already convinced him to run as a Democrat with the threat of the IRS investigation over his head. But the guys at CREEP, remember the committee to reelect the president?
Yes.
So the creeps at CREEP are running all of these different scenarios. And one of them is, oh shit, what if Wallace gets kicked out of the Democratic Party and between May or June and November, he can run his own campaign again as an independent, and he's going to take votes from Nixon. He's not going to take any votes from McGovern in the fall.
Got you.
So here we go again with a scenario where it could get thrown to the House of Representatives.
Meanwhile,
so Wallace has got to go.
Yeah. Well, meanwhile, Nixon is thinking about all of this, and you know what he's not thinking about? The American people.
Well, he's got a lot of cookie jars with his hands in them.
Of stuff that is very selfish to think about.
So hang on to that thought about Nixon's desperation and paranoia and what he might do to win. All right. So we've gotten you. We've gotten George Wallace.
Yes.
To that shopping mall in Laurel, Maryland on May the 15th, 1972.
Making his final speech.
That's right. There's one other man who figures into this story today that we need to focus on. And we will tell you everything that you need to know about him after these words from our sponsors. Today's episode is brought to you in part by A&W Outdoor Services. You know, they're located right here in Cherokee County. And I called Alan myself just a few weeks ago, and he and his crew came out to my house, pressure washed the whole thing. It looks brand new. Well, as brand new as my house can possibly look after 25 years. But all I did was call Alan at 256-706-7964. He and the guys showed up and cleaned up everything. It looked fantastic. The pollen has fallen a little bit since then. So if you haven't done this already, now's the perfect time to call Alan and A&W Outdoor Services at 256-706-7964 and let them do for you what they've already done for me.
It's time to plan your best vacation ever right here in Cherokee County, Alabama.
Many outdoor adventures await. Wet a hook in beautiful Weiss Lake, swing away at Cherokee Pines Golf Club, climb to the best view around at Cherokee Rock Village, hike the Little River Canyon National Preserve, take a days-long splash at Pirates Bay Water Park, and much, much more.
The Cherokee County Chamber of Commerce and Tourism has a full list of recommended lodging facilities, RV sites, and campgrounds, and they're all set up to suit your vacation needs, whatever they may be.
So come see us from wherever you are. And if you already live right here in lovely Cherokee County, plan your summer 2023 staycation with the Chamber by visiting cherokee-chamber.org.
Are you in the market for a full-time Weiss Lake home or recreational lot? Let Trini Davis and Elizabeth Powell put their all-star property group at Keller Williams Realty to work for you. Trini and Elizabeth are locals themselves, so they know the Weiss Lake area, and with over 40 years of experience, they're professional listing and buying agents, talented home stagers and photographers, and specialized marketing team will work to make your lakefront dreams come true. Check out the Keller Williams team on Facebook at All Star Property Rome. You can also visit at All Star Property Rome to browse their images on Instagram or give them a call at 706-844-7493. That's the All-Star Property Group with Keller Williams Realty at 706-844-7493. You can hit pause, call them now, and make your Weiss Lake dreams a reality.
Thank you to all of our sponsors, and now back to the show.
Okay, guys, so we've told you about George Wallace. Let's tell you about the other main character in today's true crime tale. Arthur Herman Bremer, B-R-E-M-E-R, Bremer. Okay. I'm going to say Brenner at some point, but it's Bremer. He was born on August the 25th, 1950. Arthur was 21 years old on the day our story takes place.
Okay. Wow, 21.
He was the son of a truck driver, a native of Milwaukee, Wisconsin. All his life, according to the people who knew him, Arthur was a loner, goofy, a weirdo. Oh, their really? Words, not
okay.
mine.
Okay.
Later, while he was in prison, Bremer wrote of his high school days that, and I'm quoting now, no English or history test was ever as difficult as waiting in the school lunch line alone, waiting to eat alone, while hundreds huddled and laughed and stared at me.
Oh.
Most recently employed as a school janitor part-time, Arthur Bremer was tired of being overlooked and laughed at by the rest of the world by the spring of 1972.
Aww.
In the couple of months before he fired 5 shots at Governor Wallace from 3 feet away, Arthur Bremer had been looking for someone in the American political arena to assassinate, mainly because he was tired of being nobody. He wanted to be famous.
That's not a good way to do it,
no,
Arthur.
You and I know that.
Not.
He followed President Nixon to Canada in April of 72 to try and assassinate him there during a visit to our neighbors to the north, but the opportunity never presented itself. Bremer had also been conspicuous around the Wallace campaign in the week before May the 15th.
Well, Nixon probably listened to his Secret Service when they said, don't go out into the crowd. Stay where we've told you.
That's correct.
And you said previously, Wallace, they told him not to.
They told him not to that day. Yeah.
And he did it anyway.
So every time they saw Bremer, he was always wearing red, white, and blue from head to toe. He wore these silver reflective sunglasses. He was he had short, light blonde hair. So he stood out in a crowd.
Yeah.
Especially the way he was dressed and the way he acted. He was overly eager to help pass out flyers, distribute Wallace campaign literature. And at all of the political rallies he attended, he always ended up in a camera shot somewhere because he always wormed his way up to the very front of the line. He always just wanted to be right there. We know why now, but they didn't know
then.
That's
just creepy.
That is.
Creepy. Weirdo. Like the people who knew him said. I mean, you're right. And whenever he traveled, Bremer used his own name when he checked into hotels or motels. In other words, he was the typical lone nut, would-be assassin, who did not take precautions to conceal his intentions because he didn't have to. He was nobody. Just like the men who shot Abraham Lincoln, James Garfield, William McKinley, John F. Kennedy, and more recently had assassinated Martin Luther King Jr. and Bobby Kennedy, lone nuts every time.
Yeah.
And in all of those cases, anonymity was their camouflage. Arthur Bremer's the same way.
Just by default.
Yeah. And by all indications, Bremer was just as much of a nobody as those other murderers were before they became murderers.
I don't know about the Lincoln guy because, you know, he was kind of
a famous actor. Nobody suspected. Well, then you're right. And he hid his intentions with his notoriety.
Yeah.
Right?
You're right. He did.
Yeah. Well, now there was kind of a conspiracy there, I guess.
Maybe.
Yeah.
You talked
Go back
about
and
that.
Listen to our episode about the Lincoln assassination.
Yeah.
Shameless.
I forgot to write that down.
It's this season.
It's this season.
Season 3. Yeah.
So Bremer, just like everybody else, he wanted his name on this list. He wanted to be on the same list with John Wilkes Booth and Charles Guiteau and Leon Czolgosz and Lee Harvey Oswald and James Earl Ray and Sirhan Sirhan. He wanted to be on that list.
Well, that's quite a list to aspire to. Yeah.
Multiple news outlets reported that when Bremer was being dragged away from the scene of the crime, he asked one of the police officers holding him by the arms what he thought his autobiography might be worth.
Wow.
Now, perhaps the reason Bremer asked that question was because FBI found in his car the next day after his arrest his 137-page diary that he began writing when he decided what he was going to do. The first sentence on the first page reads this way. Now I start my diary of my personal plot to kill by pistol either Richard Nixon or George Wallace.
Well, that's incriminating. And I thought you were going to say, I kept waiting on the word.
That is incriminating.
I kept waiting on the word manifesto. I was like,
come on.
I think 137 pages is too short to be a manifesto.
It is. It has to be longer. Okay.
The next year, Harper's Bazaar printed that entire thing in a 6-part series.
Really?
Wow.
In the magazine. And I tried to get a subscription on the website earlier this week, and it's so complicated. It wants to sign me in as my Facebook account or my Google account, and then it wouldn't let me, and then I got my passwords all fudged up.
Okay, so
come on. So I gave up on it.
Harper's Bazaar.
Yeah, get it together, Harper's.
Let's make that easier.
Yeah. Okay, so now we're back in drone mode.
Here we are.
Hovering over the parking lot in Laurel, Maryland.
He's shaking hands with everybody. They told him not to.
That's right.
Okay.
So.
He was behind a bulletproof
lectern when he was speaking.
When he was speaking.
But now he's down in the crowd. And the way that we know what happened is because there was a CBS News cameraman who had been following the Wallace campaign for weeks. And everything that happened next is recorded for posterity. You can watch it on YouTube.
Oh, wow.
In the low definition images that are typical of the time, Wallace is seen working his way along a line of people after finishing his campaign speech outside the strip mall. As we mentioned, it was a hot afternoon, suit coats off. Watch the video a few times. It's on YouTube, like I said, and you'll be able to see Brimmer, light-haired and wearing those reflective glasses in his red, white, and blue outfit, worming his way up towards the front few rows of the crowd.
Oh, you see him like worming his way up
with his hand out. After you watch it a couple of times, you can pick him out when you see what's happening. And he's shouting out, George, George, come over here and shake my hand. Just as Wallace sticks his hand in the direction of the voice, Brimmer reaches through the front row of spectators. He rests his gun hand on the left shoulder of a white-haired older lady, and with his stub-nosed 38 sitting right there, begins firing.
Oh, my gosh.
Bang, 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 bang. Five shots.
Well, I bet she lost hearing in that ear.
I bet she did. And then scuffling and shouting. We're still on the video. And screaming. And amidst the screams, Brimmer's face disappears beneath a mass of humanity. People jerking at him, punching him, pushing him to the ground. The cameraman gets bumped. The lens rattles for a couple of seconds. And then the cameraman, no mediocre journalist this guy, remembers that he needs to find Governor Wallace in his eyepiece. And when he does, quickly, he looks right down to his feet. And there's Wallace lying with his legs sprawled awkwardly. He's on his back on the asphalt. His blue short-sleeve dress shirt is already saturated with blood. The woman in the yellow dress who throws her body on top of Wallace is his second wife, Cornelia. Later news reports reveal that there was a doctor in the crowd, so within seconds, Wallace and the three other men who received bullet wounds were being tended to, and in a few minutes, Wallace was whisked away in an ambulance. One bullet had ripped through Wallace's forearm and shoulder. Another entered his right abdomen and stomach. A third bullet pierced his rib cage and lodged in his spine.
Oh.
According to George Jr. in his book, his father told him later that his entire life passed before his eyes on his way to the ground.
Well, yeah.
And according to George Jr., also, the governor never lost consciousness while he laid there. What he did was, in those moments, Wallace remained immobile with his eyes closed, and he explained later that he played dead because he was afraid there might be a second gunman in the crowd.
Yeah, it's a good idea.
All right, so let's take a breath. How about a couple of moments of levity amidst all of this carnage?
Okay.
Ross Spiegel was the husband of the white-haired lady that I just mentioned.
Yes.
He was standing right behind his wife, which means he was standing right beside Brimmer when the shots were fired. As he told the Washington Post afterward, I climbed up on this man, I throwed my legs around him, grabbed his head, and down we went.
Dang.
And according to George Jr.'s book, again, when a Secret Service agent ran over to kneel down to check on Wallace, the agent still had his gun drawn, and it was unintentionally pointing at the governor's head. Wallace reached up, pushed the gun to the side, and said, I wish you wouldn't point that at me. I've already been shot enough for one day.
Oh. And you can hear him saying that with his, like, Southern
of course.
Politician
accent.
You know,
that South Alabama accent.
Sick, thick.
Been shot enough for one day.
Oh, God, yes.
I wish you wouldn't point that at me. Foghorn Leghorn.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
So, yeah, even lying there on the ground, Wallace at least kept his sense of humor.
Be a professional here.
George Wallace would not leave his bed at Holy Cross Hospital for 7 weeks, and he would never walk again.
I figured that when you said the spine.
Yeah, and we'll wrap up the George Wallace portion of this story shortly. Meanwhile, back in the shopping mall parking lot, Arthur Brimmer was bloody by the time three policemen dragged him into a waiting patrol car.
He got beat up by a crowd.
Yeah. And it came to light during Brimmer's trial, which began within 3 months of the shooting, that he had lost his job as a busboy at the Milwaukee Athletic Club in late 1971 because customers complained that he talked to himself. Angered by his demotion, Brimmer quit that job in February. And then that's when he began keeping the diary. That's when he began devising his plot to turn himself from a nobody into a somebody. I can report to the two of you here now that Brimmer's attempt to make sure he was no longer casually disregarded was a total failure for, among other reasons, that he was tried and convicted in a trial that lasted 5 days.
Oh.
The defense argued that Brimmer was legally insane at the time of the shooting, but the jury didn't buy that. And after deliberating for 95 minutes, Brimmer got sentenced to 63 years in prison for a variety of offenses.
But let me just
including
say
attempted
this.
Murder.
Let me just say this. Let me just be devil's advocate for just a second.
Sure.
Because he's not even hiding that he's trying to do this.
Right.
He's out in the open. He's using his own name. I can see where that would be a good defense. Because part of that is
you'd have to be nuts,
not understanding right from wrong. Well, you're not even trying to conceal what you're doing. Mm-hmm. And that part of that is one of the reasons you want to conceal it is because you know what you're doing is wrong.
Yeah.
So I can totally understand that defense, but it just didn't work.
Something worked because they gave him 63 years, but he appealed that sentence and they knocked 10 years off of it. And the appeal gave him a 53-year sentence.
And the other question is, do you really think he can get a fair trial anywhere?
They tried him right there in Maryland. And I mean, look, let's think about it. I suppose, just bear with me for a second. I suppose the attempt on George Wallace's life was not a total loss for Arthur Brimmer, because the pathetic misfit and loner was famously the inspiration for Robert De Niro character Travis Bickle in the 1976 Martin Scorsese film Taxi Driver. About a lone nut who becomes increasingly detached from reality and eventually tries to assassinate a political candidate before turning his attention to rescuing a 13-year-old prostitute played by a 12-year-old Jodie Foster.
Yes.
Katie, have you seen Taxi Driver?
No. Add that to the list. Put it to the top.
Yeah. I watched it this morning. I hadn't seen it in 10 years. I watched it this morning. I've been up since 5. I couldn't sleep
this
morning.
It's
pretty
good.
Let me add it to the list.
Nominated for Best Picture, and De Niro and Foster were nominated for their roles. Nobody won. Rocky won the Oscar for Best Picture that year.
That's a good movie, too. Katie, have you seen Rocky?
I have seen Rocky.
Okay. I was about to say.
I have seen Rocky. I don't think I've seen them all.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, okay. There are a lot of them now.
Well, okay, I'll take that back.
Adding it to my increasing
list. Wow.
Look how long
you're
going to
need a bigger phone.
I have not seen the newer Rockies.
The Creed.
And all of that.
I think there's 3 Creed movies now.
But I have heard that they're really good.
Yeah. So nothing but good things about the Creed movies.
Yeah. I should check those out.
Taxi Driver?
Taxi Driver. 1976. De Niro. He was still unknown then.
Oh, okay.
I mean, he had been in another Scorsese movie. I read this morning. He'd been in another Scorsese movie that had just come out. So, and he was in Italy shooting a second film, and he was flying back and forth from Italy to New York to shoot Taxi Driver. Mm-hmm. And somebody recognized him. What he did was he would take 12-hour shifts as a taxi driver to prepare for the role. De Niro.
Wow.
And so one night somebody got into the cab and had recognized him from that one other film he'd been in. And so he made a joke. He's like, yeah, you know, one week you're on the silver screen, the next week you're driving a cab.
And they just rolled with it.
Yeah.
Like, whatever. That's awesome.
And if you know anything about your assassination history, you know that the 81 attempt on Ronald Reagan's life, Taxi Driver, was what inspired John Hinckley Jr. to do that, because he was infatuated with Jodie Foster, and he thought that if he killed the president, she would notice him and want to go out with him.
He's not her type, if you know what I mean.
Well, nobody knew that then.
Life imitating art, then art imitating life.
That's true. That's true.
Vice versa.
And as we have mentioned about this lone nut assassin thing, George Wallace Jr. does not buy that theory. In his book, again, one more time, he still thinks that Nixon had something to do with having his father shot.
Oh. Well, and again, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I can understand someone thinking that.
Well, our old friend E. Howard Hunt, in his autobiography, he wrote that on the day after the assassination or the shooting of George Wallace, Chuck Colson, one of those guys at Creep, he was the cutthroat, would do anything to get Nixon reelected. All of them were, but Colson was one of the worst. Mm-hmm. He called E. Howard Hunt the next day and wanted him to fly to Milwaukee and plant George McGovern campaign literature in Brimmer's apartment so that it would look like McGovern had Wallace shot to keep him from mucking up the Democratic primary.
Good Lord.
And E. Howard Hunt says that he denied. He refused to do that.
Well, at least he refused to do that.
Yeah. And that's all speculation. That's all conjecture. And there remains to this day no hard proof that any of that scenario actually occurred. And Arthur Brimmer is not talking. Oh, did I mention he's still alive?
Where is Arthur now?
Brimmer was released from prison in 2007 at the age of 57, which makes him 73 now. His probation ends in 2025.
Wow.
Conditions of his release include electronic monitoring and, here's a no-brainer, orders to stay away from politicians and political candidates.
So he just has orders to do this? They're just assuming that he's going to do this?
That's right.
Wow.
Where is he?
He's in Maryland. He's living in sort of like a, he can't get a job. He can't do anything. Article that I read, there's a church outreach group that kind of takes care of indigent and people who are involved in the parole system, but don't have any means of support. And he's involved in that somehow.
He's a client of theirs.
I guess that's what you would call it.
I mean, not me over here worried about the assassin.
Yeah. Well, he's 73. I guess they figure he's harmless now.
And he's been out for quite some time.
Yeah, he's been out for 16 years.
Hasn't reoffended.
Right, okay. As far as we know. George Wallace, as we mentioned earlier, he was wheelchair-bound for the rest of his life. He did run for and was elected governor of Alabama twice more in 74 and then again in 82. And in 1982, before that election, the former boxer decided that was his fifth run for governor. Remember, he lost in 58 the first time.
Yeah.
And so what he did, one of his platforms was he asked his old punching bags, the black people of Alabama, to forgive him for his past indiscretions regarding the way he spoke about them on the campaign trail. And Wallace got overwhelmingly the black vote in 82.
Wow.
Yeah.
What?
Now, was Wallace sincere when he did that, or was it just one last lashing out of a politician?
Selling of the soul?
Doing what he had to do to get elected.
You know, it's very difficult to say because...
It is very difficult to say.
Was he a racist, or was he true? Was he at one point believed what he was saying and doing, and then all of a sudden realized that he had been wrong the whole time?
Strangely, he ended up with the majority of the electorate in both 64 or 62 and 82. He's going with what the majority think.
And you like to think that he truly had a heart changing.
If you watch the videos of some of the speeches that he gave later in his life, he certainly looks sincere.
He comes across as, and you certainly hope that he was. Yeah. And obviously, folks in the black community are believing him because they're voting for him.
Now, there's this one sequence where he tears down his cheeks and he's sitting in front of a church congregation. He says, "I'm sorry, I was wrong," and he's crying. And the audience, that was the church, the Methodist church in downtown Montgomery, where Martin Luther King Jr. had preached before he became the voice of the civil rights movement.
So that's
before Rosa Parks in 55.
So that's either a major political stunt.
Yeah.
Or he's sincere.
He loved to run for office. Former.
God, that's a tough one.
I know. Former U.S. Congressman and the late John Lewis, who was a young man and had been beaten by Wallace's state troopers at the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma in 1965. Was interviewed in the months after Wallace passed away, and he said that he had forgiven George Wallace, but that he would never forget what Wallace did in the name of his political aspirations.
There you go.
So that's John Lewis's interpretation of what George Wallace's motivations were. There's a 1997 film that was made by Warner Brothers for TNT titled George Wallace, and I bought it for $8. I had to watch DVDs. I didn't know that my Xbox would play DVDs. I just dropped them in thinking this is never going to work. And it did. It played them. So I watched both of those yesterday. It was a two-part series.
Who plays Wallace?
Gary Sinise.
Oh, okay.
And was and
Lieutenant
won
Dan?
Lieutenant Dan. And he won a Primetime Emmy Award for that role. Uh-huh. And guess who plays Cornelia Wallace? The young second wife.
Who?
A young Angelina Jolie.
Good Lord.
She won a Golden Globe Award for her role in that film.
Wait, what's this film called?
It's called George Wallace. It's a two-part DVD. Gary Sinise, George Wallace, look it up.
Okay.
Now, there were a few liberties that were taken with the facts, but I watched it having read all of this other stuff, and it was pretty much spot on.
Mm-hmm.
The Wallace family didn't care for it, obviously. We can probably add that to the list of films that Katie hasn't seen, and perhaps Kelly hasn't seen. I'd never seen it. I think it was on TNT. It was made in 97, so it was a two-night miniseries that was run. It might have come out in 98, but Wallace died in 98, so I'm assuming that it was timed around.
Yeah, I was like four, so I wasn't watching TNT.
I was in my first year at Auburn, so I probably...
Yeah, you weren't watching it.
Yeah, no.
Right. Yeah, we had cable, and I had MTV for the first time, so I was watching Monty Python's Flying Circus, I imagine. And guys, that's pretty much it. I've wrapped the whole darn thing up. That's the story of the attempted assassination of George Wallace in May of 1972.
And so Brimmer,
I don't know how we're going to fit that title.
Brimmer is out.
And Brimmer is out and
old,
about.
Yeah. But hasn't harmed anyone since his release.
Not enough to make the papers.
Okay.
Or the TV.
All right.
News. So,
well, I guess there'll be no updates unless Brimmer reoffends, right?
Correct. And he's, you know, how much more time does he?
I don't know.
Possibly have to do that.
I'm not a doctor. I don't know.
Oh yeah, that's right. I forgot.
Well, thank you, Scott. That was way more interesting than I thought.
It was way more interesting than I thought it was going to be when I started.
That was really good. I enjoyed it, and I learned all kinds of new things today.
Well, don't forget to say something cool about us on your social media platform of choice or wherever you listen to us on your podcast platforms, because our goal here is to be completely famous one of these days. And when we are on one side of the velvet rope at the red carpet, we will not forget about you.
Oh,
stop us. We will sign autographs. Please say something nice about us. It helps us, and it makes us more popular.
And I forgot that Scott talked Shane into letting us be a sponsor of the Motown show coming up.
July the 28th.
So get your tickets for that.
How about that?
You'll see our sponsorship there.
We'll be there. Love Maybe it. We'll be outside signing autographs that night.
Yeah, exactly.
Maybe that's a terrible idea. Is that it? Are we done?
We're done.
Good night, everybody.